Welcome to the Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks for listening this week. Bubble Talk is back in the Magic City. Another condo bust looms in Miami, reported the Wall Street Journal this week. The South Florida Business Journal was a bit more reserved. There's a slowdown impacting Miami's condo market, is what it wrote. Real estate values have recovered, certainly from the depths of the Great Recession less than a decade ago. Those memories remain fresh, though, for a lot of homeowners away from the beach and our city centers. Property tax collections have rebounded, ending years of cutbacks and public government belt tightening. But it's been an uneven real estate recovery here in South Florida. About one in every seven homeowners is still underwater. They owe more on their mortgage than their home is worth. Price hikes have slowed down. The pace of sales has slowed down. Construction, especially of condos, has slowed down. So is another real estate bust just around the corner for South Florida, or is this, and it's dangerous to say it, different this time? Are you buying or selling real estate? What's your experience been? Are you a renter? Are you hoping that the bubble bursts and you're able to swoop in and buy low? Let us know here as we begin with Bubble Talk in Real Estate on the Florida Roundup, 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576. Send us a tweet at WLRN and find us on Facebook as well. Laura Cusisto is the U.S. housing reporter for the Wall Street Journal behind this week's article. Brian Bandel writes for the South Florida Business Journal. And Nick Nehemas writes for Real Estate and our partner, the Miami Herald, with us from our studios in Doral. Laura, let's begin with your piece. You wrote in your lead that, quote, Miami is facing a condo bust again. What evidence did you find that the bust is coming?
So I think you see sort of some of the classic signs of a bust. You see inventory up. You see sales down by about 20%. You see developers putting projects on hold. And you also see developers offering increasingly creative incentives like, like private access to a private jet service. developers will tell you, and I think they're right, that they've done certain things so that this bust probably won't look the same as the last one, and it might not be as bad. But there are definitely sort of telltale signs of what I would call a pretty significant slowdown.
Brian, you wrote, meantime, that the slowdown is, quote, transforming how condos are built and sold. Laura referred to some of the changes that developers are already responding to. What are those changes, and how are they impacting sales?
Well, developers have realized that sales have slowed down, so they need to capture the right kind of buyer. You can't depend on selling to buyers in Latin America who are going to be investors who are going to rent them out now. And I think they're going to have to try and sell to second home buying Latin Americans, which means larger units, better locations, better amenities, things you could really live in. Or maybe take the other route and sell, if you're going to build for people who are going to invest and rent, smaller units that are less expensive. Mm-hmm. Related group is looking at doing micro units. But I just don't think it's a bust because I don't see a giant drop in values. I don't see a 30 or 40% drop in values. I think it's more of you're going to have fewer sales. You're going to have projects that don't get off the ground. But I don't think it'll be like last time where projects stopped in the middle of construction and there were huge discounts to units. I just don't see that happening because most of the deals now are all cash.
And last time, of course, what began in the beach and the condominium market quickly washed through all the way to the Everglades, all the way to even the rural communities here in South Florida. And we'll get to all of that here. But Nick, any of this slowdown, how concentrated is some of the data that we're seeing slowing in any particular neighborhoods?
Well, we're really seeing it in the luxury markets, so Miami Beach and Sunny Isles, Brickell and downtown. The areas where working and middle-class South Floridians live, you know, Little Haiti, Little Havana, West Coconut Grove, those areas, inventory is really tight, prices are still rising, and affordability is the big problem for people there. They're not worried about a slowdown in the luxury condo market. They don't really see that affecting them like it did last time.
Laura, when you talk about developers offering private jet plane rides, you know, these are clearly not housing units that are designed for police officers and school teachers.
Yeah, and actually, I think that's interesting. So I can give kind of a national perspective. That's really the story across the country, that you see luxury markets from Manhattan to Southern California really slowing down, partly because of declining foreign interest, and partly because that's mostly what we've been building everywhere. Mm. And so I think the story in Miami in that sense is going to play out very similar to what's going on everywhere else.
Which is a lot different than the 2006-2007 collapse, which began at the single-family home level in subprime lending and kind of median average Americans.
And also in South Florida, that collapse was also part of that with the new condo market. People were putting down, you know, 10%, 20% deposits, and they couldn't close when these units were done. The difference now is people are putting down 50% deposits. Yeah. And according to the Miami DDA, most of the people are closing with all cash. So you don't have a bank forcing you to discount your unit and sell.
Back in January, we spoke with the head of condominium development at Related Group, one of the largest builders here in South Florida, Carlos Russo. His assessment of the condo market just 3 months ago was this.
We're building a lot less units. Why? Because before it was a lot easier to find buyers to pony up with 20% deposits. Now we have to get 50% deposits. So my width of buyers has suddenly shrunk, and I'm only focusing the guys who can really close with 50% deposits. We are not allowing anybody to flip their contracts before the building is finished, which is also a huge change. And the banks are being a lot more stringent with the lending.
A lot more money down and a lot more stringent on lending requirements. Is this time different for Miami real estate? What's your experience been? 800-743-9576, 800-743-WLRN. Has your home just gotten out from underwater, perhaps with the risk of it going back under if South Florida real estate values happen to get softer than where they are today? Join the Florida Roundup on social media, at WLRN on Twitter, and look for us on Facebook as well. Laura, I want to get back to this idea of kind of a national perspective. Laura Cusisto with the Wall Street Journal with us from the Journal's newsroom. You talked about kind of this slowdown happening in the luxury market. Here, that has been concentrated and certainly exposed to Latin America, the Brazilian economy in the year two of a recession and a political scandal that continues to threaten to hold down that economy. We've seen economic slowdowns in Mexico, in Colombia, in Peru. Really, Argentina is about the only bright spot when it comes to the Latin American economic situation. And that clearly is beginning to see some impact here in South Florida. Is that slowdown in Latin America being exported to other locations?
Yeah, so I think different markets have depended on different kinds of foreign buyers. So I also wrote probably back in November about a slowing in interest from Chinese buyers. And some of that was driven by anti-corruption measures that were just making it more difficult to move out money out of the country. Or, for example, I think in other parts of South Florida, Canadians are also seeing the value of their dollar drop. So we're seeing this really interesting economic trend really across the world where the U.S. is continuing to do well while almost everyone around us sort of collapses. And so that's really tough for the luxury condo market.
Nick, China has been a place where local real estate developers have been looking to replace the Latin American buyers from the past couple of years.
Yeah, there's been a lot of interest down here flying to China, developers and realtors, but it just doesn't seem realistic at this point, especially, you know, given the measures Laura was talking about. There's no direct flight from Miami to Beijing. We're definitely seeing a few Chinese buyers, and they do buy at a high price point, but the idea that they could replace the fall off from Latin America is totally unrealistic.
The sheer volume, Brian, has got to be clearly different, but also the anti-corruption measures that Laura referred to. There was a U.S. Treasury Department order that was put in place on real estate transactions in Miami-Dade County that we know we've heard from real estate professionals in Broward County and Palm Beach County to say it's been helping drive sales there because they're not under this same federal scrutiny to report sources of dollars when they're involved with real estate transactions.
Yes, and that is for transactions of over $1 million. So for the luxury units, and some of these projects are $1 million, and $1 million is the bottom price.
Because we are talking about luxury buyers right here, definitely.
Yeah. Then that's going to impact them. A lot of these people don't want their names known in their countries to regulators. Some of these people, they're not all criminals. Some of them just don't want to pay taxes, you know, in their home country, or they don't want to be extorted in their home country, and they're afraid of their name getting out there.
And Nick, I know the Miami Herald, along with the International Consortium of Investigative Journalists, we'll be publishing an investigation Sunday afternoon examining Miami real estate and offshore companies. What can you tell us about it?
Yes, so we're looking very closely at the connection between offshore companies, people who've been accused of corruption in Latin America and other countries around the world, and how they're using those companies to buy luxury Miami real estate. What we've found suggests that the federal regulators have a strong case to be taking a hard look at Miami's real estate market as a place where potentially dirty money could be laundered. A
lot of shadow money. And Brian, I know you've written on this as well a year or so ago, looking at some of the shadow money, especially in the North Miami Beach and Sunny Isles area.
Yeah, there are a lot of concerns because of the Florida LLC laws allow you to...
Limited liability corporations.
Yeah, exactly. You can buy things without managing members, or the managing member can just be an attorney. We don't really know where the money is coming from. And that's been an issue in forming all kinds of companies in South Florida. So the developers just want to get a sale. They don't necessarily care who they're selling to.
We've been concentrating on the luxury market here in Miami. What about where regular Floridians live, quote-unquote regular Floridians live? How's it impacting your neighborhood, your community? 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576. Joanne is joining us. Go ahead, Joanne. Welcome to the program.
Yes, hi, good afternoon. Two just quick points. I have bought and sold real estate, you know, quite over the years, a number of times. Recently bought my home about 8 months ago. It was the worst experience ever. I mean, and you're talking, I have an average 800 credit score, and, you know, the deposit was large. What they put you through was absolutely horrendous.
Was this the lender you're talking about to get a mortgage, or the actual process?
Right.
Okay.
Lender in South Florida because of the fraud and corruption. And this is what I was told, number one, that goes on here. Number two, the inventory was absolutely, you know, atrocious. Three, why is it that they're allowing the Latin Americans to come in here and drive the market where we're living here and cannot purchase the home? A lot of the investors are coming in, cash dollars, and it makes it very hard when you bid on a property to be able to purchase that home.
Yeah, Joanne, we appreciate
Thank
your
you.
Thoughts. I don't think there's anybody necessarily allowing one thing or one buyer from one country or another buyer to another country happens. Nick Nahamas from our partner, the Miami Herald, you and I have toured some of these neighborhoods together when we were working on some reporting back in the fall. You know, buyers are looking for dollars. They're looking for the easiest close. They're looking for as few hiccups that can happen in the closing process to make sure the deal gets done and the cash winds up in their account.
Exactly. And I think Joanne brings up a frustration that a lot of South Floridians feel that they are simply, you know, getting outbid. The foreign investment has definitely put Miami on the world stage, but it's also made it a lot harder for locals to find affordable places to live just because all of the housing stock is being produced on the luxury end. Yeah. And what's available, you sometimes can't get a loan for it.
Yeah, and you heard Joanne's frustration with the inventory. Laura Cusisto, the national housing reporter for the Wall Street Journal, you mentioned inventory as one of those pieces of evidence that the potential of a Miami real estate bust could be just around the corner. That inventory of housing stock that is not luxury, that is not oceanside, that is not beachside, is still being driven by pretty positive fundamentals. Population growth continues. 350,000 new people call South Florida home today compared to 6 years ago. Job growth continues. The unemployment rate continues to dip. So if this South Florida luxury market happens to burst or slow down, is that going to cause some economic shrapnel in these other localized markets?
Yeah, I think one thing we've written about across the country is the bifurcation of the housing market, where there is definitely oversupply, or what looks to be oversupply, on the luxury end. There appears to be a slowdown coming in the luxury end. But on the lower end, you still have incredibly tight supply. You know, the story that your caller was just telling is absolutely typical, that people go from house to house and there's almost nothing on the market and it's not very good. And so I think one of the questions is going to be, can developers pivot? You know, have they bought land at a price where they can maybe do some of what we were talking about, build smaller units, build to that demographic that's still very much there still seems to be very much strong demand.
The challenge in Miami is that the luxury condo boom has driven construction prices up so high, it makes it challenging to build anything affordable. Kevin Maloney, the head of PMG, told me that the construction prices went from 150 a square foot to 400 a square foot. So you have to charge a lot to make profit on that. And it doesn't matter where you build. I mean, it's going to still cost you a lot. So how do you build something affordable if construction goes down and some of the luxury projects fade, then the prices to build might ease a little bit.
And this gets to the argument of the UDB, at least in Miami-Dade County, the urban development boundary, and those folks wanting to continue to push it out into the Everglades to say we need cheaper land to be able to bring those construction costs down to be able to afford, be able to put together some affordable housing for folks that have a median income here in South Florida. Let's go to Veronica, who's joining the Florida Roundup from Wynwood. Veronica, welcome. Go ahead.
Hi. So I just have a quick comment. I live in Wynwood. I've been living there for 3 years now, and I've seen changes, and changes are good, but sometimes they're not that great. And I feel that, you know, young people that are professionals, I have a full-time job and all that, we don't, like, if I want to buy something around the area, it's impossible. All this, I see all this new development is this luxury million-dollar things that, you know, people like us cannot buy, and we want to stay there. We are the young people that are driving the area and bringing people in, and we don't have that opportunity. All the development around is just too expensive. And I've seen the plans. I'm actually an urban planner, and I'm kind of informed, and I know what's going on. And it's not something that I feel gives opportunity for people like us.
Veronica, you know? I know it's always dangerous to guess someone's age, but a millennial, are you a millennial?
I'm 30, so I don't know.
Falls in the millennial definition. And the reason I ask, Veronica, is you're not alone. We've seen research out that finds the millennial population is actually shrinking in South Florida. So the overall population is growing, but this population of young professionals, millennials, early 20s to early 30s, back a half a generation ago, it was better than 1 in 5. Now it's below 1 in 5. And so this, you know, this exodus is happening, Veronica, with young professionals your age here in South Florida. But Laura, I want you to comment here. Tampa, Orlando, Jacksonville, those housing markets have actually experienced small gains in millennial populations. And so what does that mean for those markets, the sustainability or the stabilization of those markets elsewhere in Florida?
Yeah, so I think one of the points of tension you see also kind of across the country is that a lot of the markets that are most affordable to millennials are also not the markets where you have a lot of jobs that are geared towards them. And so I guess that'll be kind of a question for those markets. It could be really good news for them if they're relatively affordable and if they're attracting younger people, but can they offer the kinds of job opportunities that a lot of these people who are kind of coming out with college degrees, looking for jobs in tech, that kind of thing, can they respond? Because I think that's going to be a crucial part of the picture.
It just hurts, though, to lose to Jacksonville and Orlando to Tampa. I gotta say, a little civic pride here, right? Let's go to Dorothea from South Miami on line 2. Dorothea, welcome to the Florida Roundup. Go ahead.
Hi. Thank you for having me. I just wanted to follow up on a comment that Joanne made about the inventory for single-family homes being so expensive here in South Florida, Miami in particular. I am a local realtor, and I specialize in the city of South Miami, Coral Gables, Pinecrest, and the surrounding areas. One of the reasons that developers are buying and building such expensive single-family homes is because we really don't have any more land, which is another reason right. ties back into why we're building up. So the developers who do have the opportunity to purchase homes that are maybe older, that are knocked down, that they can rebuild, spec homes and the like, one of the reasons they are so expensive is because the land is so expensive and they're having to recoup the cost of expensive land, and the only way to do that is with the expensive upgrades. And it's a vicious circle that I'm seeing more and more, and it's harder for millennials, like just the previous caller to really get into the single family home market, and that's tying back into driving rental prices up. And I just see this very vicious circle, and I wish there was something else we could do. Unfortunately, we can't plant new land.
Well, what you're going to see is the micro unit trend, and Related has told me, and some other developers have told me what they're doing is imagine living in a 400 square foot apartment, one bedroom, or a 750 square foot apartment, two bedroom, basically two people renting. That's where we're headed now. They're going to pack as much on as they can, and they're going to places like Wynwood where you can relax the parking requirements, so you don't have to build many parking spaces, really bring down the cost. And so the rent will be affordable. You'll just have to get used to a large walk-in closet space.
And the other part, to Dorothea's point, and Laura, I'd like you to comment on it here. I mean, we are hemmed in South Florida, caught between two great bodies of water, the Atlantic Ocean and the Everglades. You know, the new land that was created in South Florida was created by draining the Everglades and digging out those canals and putting that land in Biscayne Bay. Those days are over. Are we looking at a situation that is akin to a Hong Kong, which is hemmed in, like San Francisco, like Manhattan, that has no more developed arable land, or something, or some other kind of scenario?
Yeah, I mean, you absolutely see a very direct correlation between home prices and two things, both how easy it is to find more land to develop and then how tight regulations are. And so depending on what direction Miami heads with those things, I think there's no question. I mean, it would take a while for Miami to catch up with New York, but or with San Francisco. But I would imagine that would be the direction that you would see things head in, especially, again, for a lot of these neighborhoods that have traditionally been really easy neighborhoods for someone to buy a house in their 30s, or, you know, it might become a little bit more difficult. A
lot of complex issues here. Land use requirements, zoning laws involved here. Michael is joining the Florida Roundup talking real estate from Miami. Michael, welcome to the program. Go ahead.
Yeah, so a partner and I were looking to do a small mixed-use development, and we were wanting to do it somewhere with an ocean view. And it quickly became apparent that in the few places where we could afford to do that, the zoning laws were not permissive for us to do that. And the only people who get exemptions on zoning laws are developers that are doing these massive condos and hotels.
You felt a David and Goliath situation with your project compared to others.
It is. And aside from that, Miami is sort of a microcosm under the microscopic view of what's happening in our country at large, as far as economically speaking and culturally speaking. So we have such bifurcation here between the rich and the poor. And there's a very small middle class in Miami, incredibly small. And so these people are coming in to buy properties that they intend to rent out. There's not going to be anyone who can afford to rent those places that can't afford to buy. You know, so because there's no middle class.
Michael, we appreciate the insights. Michael joining us there from Miami. It is a blood sport, real estate here in South Florida. Nick Nehamas with our partner, the Miami Herald. Look for his writing with the International Consortium of Investigative Journalists and the Miami Herald Sunday afternoon. Laura Cusisto with the Wall Street Journal, national housing correspondent, joining us from the Journal's newsroom. And Brian Bandel with the South Florida Business Journal. Thanks to all three of you for joining us here on the Florida Roundup today.
Thank you.
Thanks so much.
Still to come on the program, the trouble picking a new insurance regulator here in the Sunshine State just as storm season approaches. That's next. We're back on the Florida Roundup here on WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks again for listening. It's only when something bad happens that the intangible nature of insurance becomes real. Getting sick, a car crash, or a hurricane, for instance. Florida hasn't had a big storm, hasn't had any hurricane, in fact, in a decade. But with another storm season approaching, the state is still looking for an insurance commissioner. The ever-rising windstorm insurance rates to Obamacare. Insurance is big, big business and big, big money here in the Sunshine State. In just 1 month, Kevin McCarty is due to step down as Florida's insurance commissioner. There's no replacement yet. This week, Governor Scott and the state's chief financial officer, Jeff Atwater, could not agree on who to hire for the job. So what's at stake for homeowners and drivers with the insurance commissioner's position? It's certainly a dry topic, insurance, but we pay thousands of dollars a year for protection. Do we get what we pay for? How are Florida insurers prepared for the upcoming storm season? What about you? Have you gotten kicked out of Citizens Insurance? What are you paying to protect your home, your car, and your health? It is insurance up next here on the Florida Roundup, 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576, and on social media at WLRN on Twitter and on Facebook. Jeremy Wallace is a Tampa Bay Times reporter covering state government and politics with us from our sister station in Tallahassee, WFSU. Charles Elmore is a reporter at the Palm Beach Post with us via the telephone. Jeremy, let's start in Tallahassee here. Why couldn't Governor Scott and the chief financial officer of the state agree on a new insurance commissioner with 60 days before storm season starts?
Well, Tom, that's a good question. They didn't give us a lot of material to figure out why they were at loggerheads on this whole issue. But what was interesting is that when CFO Jeff Atwater had proposed, you know, his choice for who he wanted to be insurance commissioner, it took just seconds for, you know, Rick Scott to declare an impasse and then decide that they're not going to appoint anybody that day.
So there was no vote at all amongst the cabinet members. There was not a vote. It was just decided they weren't going to come to an agreement.
Absolutely. Huh. There's four members of the cabinet, and Governor Scott and Jeff Atwater, CFO, have to agree on one person. And that became readily apparent that they weren't going to. Jeff Atwater had his candidate. Rick Scott had his candidate, and he made it clear that he was not going to budge on it. And so they immediately moved that they would just postpone any decision on who the insurance commissioner will be for at least another month.
Yeah, the next meeting will be, I think, April 26th. Charles Elmore with the Palm Beach Post. The guy Governor Scott wanted was Jeffrey Bragg. Lots of disaster insurance experience here. He headed up the National Flood Insurance Program. He worked with FEMA. He worked with the Department of Treasury after 9/11 on terrorism risk insurance. What's the bio and the rundown on Bragg and why the governor couldn't get his guy through?
Well, I think he does bring those government and public roles to the job, but, you know, I read some blogs saying, oh, there's been such mudslinging and, you know, terrible scrutiny at the insurance commissioner's appointment. But in fact, you know, we happened to write a story that showed that shareholders had named Bragg in a suit in a flood insurance venture in the Tampa Bay area. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it raised questions of, even if that wasn't an intentional wrongdoing, it raised questions of how effective he was in efforts to to make flood insurance more affordable, provide more competition and choice for Floridians. So I think, Bragg also hurt himself when he was asked by Attorney General Pam Bondi, what about the role of navigators in health insurance? These are government-paid helpers under the Affordable Care Act. And Bragg said, I don't know what you're talking about.
So the insurance commissioner of the state of Florida, one of the largest participants in healthcare.gov, one of those up for the job, didn't know about some of the real basics around the Affordable Care Act and how that business really gets done on the ground.
And I think that was telling because it shows, you know, instead of the problem being, oh, there's too much mudslinging and why would anyone want to, you know, apply for this job, in fact, it shows that there was a big rush from 55 applicants, you know, to overnight to about two, and they were about to vote on them in the same cabinet meeting where they had their public interviews. That's like American Idol. How wise can the cabinet be to know that this guy's magic, he's got it to be insurance commissioner? So if anything, it's probably a healthy thing that they're waiting to make a choice here.
Well, the other guy out there singing his tune was a guy who's a Florida State House representative from South Florida, from Delray Beach, Jeremy Bill Hegger. He was the choice of the chief financial officer, Jeff Atwater, and the representative also has insurance experience, but an insurance experience that's a lot different than what it would be here in the state of Florida. This guy was the insurance commissioner for the state of Iowa. And as a native Iowan, I can tell you the insurance situation in Florida is probably a lot different than the insurance situation in the Hawkeye state of Iowa.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And that was one of the questions they certainly asked him about to see if he could transition. But one of the things that Hager was able to really kind of present to them is a person who's been involved in the government process. Because we know as an insurance commissioner, you're not just setting regulations and watching over the industry. You're also in constant communication with the legislature and with the cabinet.
Yeah.
And Hager really kind of tried to drive home that point in his public interview with the cabinet that he knows how to work with these people because he is one of them. And so, he also has that background working with consumers. He tried to make the case at least. So in regards to having been a representative who is accountable to constituents, he tried to use that as the one kind of voice that showed that he might be a little bit more consumer oriented.
But
to be clear,
yeah,
neither
ahead.
One of these guys really talked a lot about consumers, you know, in their interviews.
They did or did not?
They did not.
Yeah, and this is an important point, Jeremy, I think, right? Because this insurance commissioner in the state of Florida is an appointed position, number one. Used to be elected back in the 90s, but now it's an appointed position. And it really sits right at the crossroads between the insurance industry and consumers in Florida. And Charles, you've been covering this kind of intersection for a good long time. Between advocating for the industry and advocating for consumers, how do you see how these two guys at least line up, and perhaps what the cabinet is even thinking?
It's not a clean picture, right? We'd all like a clean picture where one guy's the industry guy and one guy's the consumer guy. But I think there are concerns about both candidates in this case. And in fact, it almost goes down to individual issues on something like auto insurance, our state's no-fault system. Hager filed a bill to get rid of PIP. Now, I've written stories raising the question of might that be a very good thing for drivers? This is a fraud-prone system that, in effect, duplicates health coverage people already have. So that might be seen as pro-consumer. But on other issues, Florida domestic insurers have called Hager anathema. They don't think he's working in their interest, and they say he would support changes such as to the state hurricane fund that could raise consumer bills. So it's not a clean picture of one guy's the industry guy and one guy's the consumer guy. I think you're seeing divisions within the insurance industry itself and among groups that, say they represent consumer interests.
Jeremy Wallace with the Tampa Bay Times with us in Tallahassee. I want to go back to you, Jeremy, and ask you, during this kind of interview process, this American Idol-style interview process, as Charles described it this week, we are, on the eve, maybe 60 days out and counting here of storm season. Citizens property insurance backed by state taxpayers has been in a depopulation trend. It's as small as it's been in a good long time. But how active was the discussion regarding the preparation for the insurance industry for another storm season after really what's been a very quiet 10 years and a very profitable 10 years for the insurance industry?
Well, there was probably two answers to that. One being that, I think both the candidates involved kept stressing what we've already seen happening in Florida, this emphasis on trying to redevelop the private insurance market. Both spent a lot of time in their interviews talking about their commitment to continuing these efforts, which I think a lot of people could take as a push to further do this depopulation that, of course, had mixed results depending on who you're asking. And I think the other thing that was interesting about this is that, as Charles mentioned earlier, we got to these candidates so quickly.
Yeah,
We had these 55 people, and Governor Scott only interviewed three or four of them before he put his finalists up. Atwater did a little bit more. He had about a dozen that he actually physically interviewed, and then they were before us. It was really amazing how quickly they turned around.
Charles, how do you see it as we're approaching another storm season? It's been a quiet one. There have been efforts to try to bring in insurers again to make Florida a more competitive marketplace. Certainly the CAT fund is in good shape, but $12 billion as of last June in dollars set aside. Citizens, again, is as small as it's been in a number of hurricane seasons. What about the private market?
Well, I think, that's why it does matter, who we pick here. I mean, if you think about it, we pay the highest home insurance premiums in the nation. We pay the fourth highest car insurance premiums. So this all matters. If you broke out Florida by itself, it would rank among the top 10 or 11 nations in the world in spending annual insurance premiums.
But yet, is that attracting insurance companies here to compete that presumably would at least limit the rate hikes that homeowners and car owners are seeing?
Well, I think that's going to be a challenge for any commissioner who's picked. But that's why all this whole thing matters. CFO Jeff Atwater did ask about the candidates. Where am I hearing the word consumer in here? How are you showing concern? And in fairness, Bragg, I think, did say some things that sounded good about I would be a consensus builder and so on, and I would consult all constituencies. But, make no mistake, this is an industry, it's $100 billion plus in premiums for insurance of all kinds. And, these folks make political donations, and so, it's important that the consumer and the policyholder interest you know, is represented here in the mix.
And I want to ask you about that representation with another situation that happened this week. It was in a state court, Charles, where the insurer State Farm, essentially the court said that State Farm did not have to make public how many customers it has in Florida, going against what had been a long time practice. Traditionally, you know, reporters like yourself have been able to go to the Office of Insurance Regulation and find out how many customers, how many policyholders do these private insurance companies have in the state of Florida. State Farm was told this week it did not have to share that information. So how could this affect competitiveness in Florida?
Well, I think this is one of them. I'm glad you raised this issue, because I think this is an example of where a strong Office of Insurance Regulation matters. And I don't, you know, they've clearly lost at least one round here in the legal fight. OIR has, you know, the state won this in a similar attempt in 2007. So the issue is, you know, can State Farm just on its own declare, you know what, we don't want to tell people how many people we're adding or dropping, how many customers statewide and in various counties. We don't want to say who we're canceling or not renewing. And this has been established government practice now for many years. Everybody in the state does it.
Yep.
The public can look on a state database and see it. I use it in my reporting almost every day. And now State Farm has gone to a court and found a sympathetic judge to say, well, that's, you know, we think you should be able to declare that a trade secret, so to avoid tipping off competitors, to give them, you know, to your marketing strategy. So I think there's a lot at stake here. It's very interesting to see if the Office of Insurance Regulation will appeal this. And it matters because insurance companies, you know, advertising says, hey, trust us, we're good neighbors.
Yep.
You know, we're
literally in this case. Yeah, sure. Yeah.
Yes. And but if in fact the data shows that people in your county, they're dropping thousands or tens of thousands of customers, that may matter to your perception of that company.
Sure. It also may matter if they have an inordinate number of policies in your neighborhood or are very exposed in your county or in your region, for instance,
exactly,
should there be a localized disaster. Insurance, exactly. Dry topic, but obviously very important here, and lots of drama and political intrigue happening as well in Florida. Charles Elmore, investigative reporter with the Palm Beach Post, with us on the telephone. And Jeremy Wallace, Tallahassee reporter for the Tampa Bay Times. Thanks to both of you for joining us here on the Florida Roundup today.
Thank you.
Still to come on our program, from Miami to Ferguson, Missouri, one of Miami's top police officers becomes the next chief of police in Ferguson. We'll talk with him next. Welcome back to the Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks again for listening.
A saying that all cops are bad based on the actions of a few is as horrible a stereotype as saying that all black men are bad because of the few who commit crime.
That's Delrish Moss. He's been a Miami police officer since 1984. He spoke with WLRN in January of last year about why he became a police officer.
I had two experiences that I think were pivotal to me becoming a police officer. I was walking home one day from my job at Biscayne Federal. I'm just walking, and suddenly I'm on 7th Avenue, and a police officer pulls up and pushes me against a wall. He starts to frisk me, and he sees I don't have anything. He asks me, what am I doing here? I said, I'm coming from work. And then just as suddenly as he came, he jumped in his car and he left. To him, he was a police officer. To me, he was this armed guy who jumped out of a car, and he's got me up against a wall. And I thought about all the possibilities. One, I could be shot. Two, I could go to jail for doing nothing. And then on the way home, you know, I spent the rest of the walk home looking over my shoulder, wondering, did I do something wrong simply because I was walking? Another experience I had, I was downtown again, sitting on a bus stop waiting for a bus to take me from school to my other job, because I had a couple of jobs while I was in high school. Police officer pulled up just like the other police officer, and this one got out. He started searching around the bus stop. I was the only one sitting there. He checked my bag without asking, and he told me niggers don't walk downtown after dark. I looked at him. He looked at me. Then he got in his car and he left. He wasn't there to be an officer. He was there to be a thug in a badge.
Miami Police Major Delrish Moss planned on retiring in September. Instead, he will start a new job, Chief of Police of Ferguson, Missouri. It's the same town that experienced sometimes violent protests after a white police officer, Darren Wilson, shot and killed a black 18-year-old, Michael Brown. The police officer was not prosecuted. Major Moss joins us now on the Florida Roundup. Major Moss, congratulations on the new position. Why take the job in Ferguson?
Well, looking at all of the protests and all of the things that happened in Ferguson, it sort of reminded me of what I started with Miami. We were the subject of protests and civil unrest and a number of things. And so it's sort of a hearkening back to my roots, if you will. And I think my experience is a little unique because I, one, lived in the neighborhood where riots took place and saw the victimization of people who lived there after that happens. And then later, I was a police officer when riots also took place and saw it from that different perspective. So I think my perspective is unique, and I can offer something to Ferguson.
Did you have any reservations about taking this position?
No, actually, I didn't. As a matter of fact, I think really it's more a calling, if you will, because I really had planned to retire and spend time on the beach and you know, spend time just enjoying my life. But when I saw the plight of that city, I thought, you know, my perspective is probably needed.
Tell us what your experience was in Ferguson with Ferguson during this hiring process, and what did it tell you about the engagement of city leaders in the kinds of changes, presumably, that you are representing?
Well, I think the city leaders in Ferguson now, especially with the new city manager and just this wake-up call, if you will, has really forced them to look at the city and some of the previous practices, and move in a positive direction. And I think that everybody there that I met was really eager to move forward and move in a way that spoke more about community involvement, community engagement, and so forth, and wanting to represent all segments of their population. I think, you know, a lot of people were saying that this was a bad thing, and I guess, you know, to a degree it was very bad, but I think out of all tragedy, comes a degree of triumph, and I think that's one of the things that's happening there.
You mentioned living in Miami during race riots, the McDuffie riots, what you're referring to there, and then, of course, mm-hmm. joining the force 4 years after that. How did that experience shape your policing here in Miami, and how will it shape your experience as the leader of a department under significant scrutiny, both public and regulatory scrutiny, in Ferguson?
Well, you know, I think when, you know, scrutiny is police work comes with scrutiny. And I think that if you're doing the right thing, you know, and the people are not going to always agree with you. And so, you know, that just comes with public office. But I think that my experiences really helped me to sort of understand both the police and the community side of things like this, things that happen. And I think, you know, when, you know, we police at the pleasure of the people. And one of the things that police officers often forget is that our job is about service. I think people forget that also. They think that, you know, that the entirety of the job is to go out and make arrests and bring people in. And really, that's a very small part of the job. And I think that my task will be to remind both segments, both police and the public, that, you know, the job is about service.
I want to ask you about that service, Major Moss. How would you describe the police relations in the community that you will be inheriting as the police chief in Ferguson, Missouri, compared to the police community relations here in Miami that you've experienced firsthand since the mid-1980s on the force?
Well, Miami went through a lot of changes. We went through a lot of growth. When I came on the department, we were moving in a direction, but we weren't there yet, that where we had a police department that was much more reflective of the community we serve. And the reason it was reflective was because we started pooling from the community, the police officers that we hired. And, you know, it's for them, it was about being more than a police officer. It was about actually making a difference in the very community that you had a stake in. And I think that that's something that's going to happen in Ferguson. I think one of the things that happened in Ferguson was they went from being, there was a dramatic change there. And the community went from 99% white to now 70% African-American. And I think one of the things that happened is that there wasn't much of a change in terms of the law enforcement perspective of that. And that could be because police officers just didn't leave the department for a long time. There was no turnaround. And it could be because African-Americans may not have felt that being part of law enforcement was something that within the realm of possibilities. I mean, you know, the possibilities there are wide ranging, and so it's going to be interesting to look at that and figure out how we better reflect the community.
You talk about the makeup of the force and the changes that saw in Miami after the McDuffie riots in 1980. The U.S. Justice Department and the department you're currently a major in, the Miami Police Force, reached a settlement just last month regarding a federal investigation into police excessive force involving 33 police shootings. New reforms like handling police-involved shootings, the department that handles that, more training, de-escalation training. What are these lessons of reforms are you going to export to Ferguson, which is also negotiating with the Department of Justice?
Well, certainly one of the things that the Department of Justice determined with regard to Miami was that, you know, we have a escalation of force. We're very good at the escalation of force, but we're not that good at the de-escalation of force. And so I think that's something that's duly noted. But I'll tell you that it's actually larger than policy. It also is about leadership, because the Miami Police Department under Chief John Timoney went a 12-month into a 24-month period without a single shot having been fired. Now, under the same policy, another chief came in, but a different philosophy. And that changed dramatically. So, you know, it really comes from leadership. And I think as a leader, setting the direction, setting the tone is going to be pivotal, and training to reinforce those policies. Because if you look at police departments around the country, policies are about the same. But it's how you enforce that, how you instill the philosophy, that's key. And I think my experience in Miami is going to be greatly helpful in terms of Ferguson.
Major Moss, just about a half a minute left here, but the city council in Ferguson recently rejected the settlement with the Department of Justice stemming from the Michael Brown incident, saying, among other things, that it could not come up with the finances for pay raises for police officers. Are you going to push for those pay raises?
Well, I think that the city is taking some steps to work some of those things out. You know, obviously, when you have workers, you're going to put, you know, as a leader, you are to push for the appropriate compensation for them. And so, I'll certainly be pushing to get, you know, police officers who do the job well, every benefit I can get for them.
Major Moss, because, you mentioned you're looking forward to retirement and some beach time. Not a lot of sand in Ferguson, Missouri, sir.
Yes, certainly not. But one of the things I'm going to take out there is this big picture of the beach. And so when I start to get homesick, I'll look at that picture and just sort of escape in my mind.
Be sure to take a hat and gloves as well. I hear it gets cold a few months out of the year. Miami Police Major Delrish Moss has been named the Chief of Police in Ferguson, Missouri. Thank you for your public service here to this community, and good luck in Ferguson, Missouri, sir.
Thank you very much. I appreciate it.
Thank you for joining us on the Florida Roundup. Finally on the roundup this week, Governor Scott is getting his wish. After more than 300 Yankee winters in the Northeast, Yale University is moving to Florida. Earlier this week, the governor made his pitch that Yale should change climates over taxes.
Look at all the reasons why you should come to Florida. You can look at how many people are moving here. You look at how annual income is moving here. Our weather's better. Our crime rate's at 44.5-year low. I can give you all the reasons.
Lawmakers in Yale's home state of Connecticut have floated the idea that the Ivy League school can afford to contribute more of its $25 billion endowment to the state.
They're going to tax their endowment income. Look at what's happened to their state. You know, GE's moving out of the state. You know, we have so many people moving down here. They're taxing. If you're in business in Connecticut, you're going to have to move. You can't compete in the global economy.
Yale follows General Electric, which announced back in January it was moving its headquarters to Massachusetts after being in Connecticut since 1974. Now, when making his case to Yale to pull up stakes after more than 300 years, Scott bragged about his 55 tax cuts since becoming Florida's governor in 2011. Well, Yale this week quickly studied up, and it will be coming to Florida, South Florida, in fact. In an effort to embrace its new home, it'll be changing mascots. The Bulldog, Yale's current mascot, they don't do so well in our hot and humid climate. So it will become the Yale Geckos. Also, the university's Board of Trustees has voted to rename the school Yale. It rhymes with
Dale.
That'll do it for the Florida Roundup for the week ending April 1st. You can join us on Facebook. Let us know what you're talking about. Facebook.com/groups/TheFloridaRoundup. Our program is produced by Julia Duba and Alicia Zuckerman. Our news director is Terrence Shepard. WLRN's program director is Peter J. Mayers. And our technical supervisor today, Paul Leary. Thanks, Paul. I'm Tom Hudson. Have a great weekend, and thanks for listening.